This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Thank you for listening in today. I'm Joel Hilliker. Last Friday's killing of Iranian General Qasem Soleimani was a bold, confrontational move by America against Iran. The question was, how would Iran respond? Well, we got an answer last night as the Iranians fired ballistic missiles at the U.S. and coalition forces in Iraq. But as you just heard on the Trumpet Daily Radio Show, it looks like this is actually a de-escalation. We're going to start today's show with a report from Trumpet writer Brent Nachtigall in Jerusalem about this story, and we'll talk about some of the likely long-term ramifications of what's happening here. Bible prophecy has a lot to say about Iran's role in the Middle East and also about America's long-term role there, along with other nations in the region. So we're going to talk about how this could hasten the fulfillment of those prophecies. In the second segment, I want to talk about how the press's reaction to Soleimani's death is an example of how much preconception influences perception. I recently read Shakespeare's Othello, and that play has some interesting lessons that can teach us about some of these major political trends in America right now. And after that, we'll talk about a rift in the Eastern Orthodox Church that could pave the way for a reconciliation with parts of the Eastern Church with the Roman Catholic Church. And this points directly to a prophecy that Herbert W. Armstrong highlighted decades ago about the Catholic Church bringing its wayward daughters back into the fold. We'll hear a report from Andrew Miller highlighting this very interesting prophecy. And I'll finish off the program today by giving you some timeless biblical advice on how to make your marriage work beautifully. We'll start, though, with this report on Iran's retaliation last night against the U.S. from Brent Nachtigall.
Iran's awaited response to the death of its arch general Qasem Soleimani came overnight as it fired almost two dozen ballistic missiles at the United States bases in neighboring Iraq. No American, Iraqi, or coalition servicemen were killed in the strikes, which will likely allow the serious attack to pass without a United States response. According to the Associated Press, the attack was Iran's most direct assault on America since the 1979 seizing of the U.S. Embassy in Tehran. An Iranian state TV said it was in revenge for the U.S. killing of Revolutionary Guard General Qasem Soleimani. Around 2 a.m. Iraqi time, 15 of the missiles landed at the Ain al-Assad Air Base, home to 1,500 U.S. troops and other anti-Islamic state forces. Five other missiles landed near a base in the Kurdish capital of Erbil, home to U.S. forces as well. Four missiles failed to detonate. The Ain al-Assad base is likely a symbolic target for Iran, as it was the first base used by the United States following the toppling of Saddam Hussein's regime in 2003. It was also the first Iraqi base visited by U.S. President Donald Trump back in December 2018. Nevertheless, the fact no United States serviceman was killed in the attack indicates that there will be no need for a United States response. Comments from both the United States and Iran show that it's unlikely that any further direct strikes will be forthcoming. President Donald Trump tweeted immediately following the attack this: "All is well. Missiles launched from Iran at two military bases located in Iraq. Assessment of casualties and damages taking place now. So far, so good. We have the most powerful, well-equipped military anywhere in the world by far. I'll be making a statement tomorrow morning." A statement from the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps during the attack, codenamed Martyr Soleimani, warned of more attacks if the Great Satan responded to its missiles. However, a tweet from Iran's Foreign Minister Javad Zarif following the event also implied that the overnight missile strike was enough retribution for the death of Soleimani. The fact that missiles were fired directly from Iranian territory against American interests, a first for the 40-year-old Islamic Republic, will likely be enough to save face and de-escalate the situation. Iranian media is also claiming that the United States is trying to cover up the supposed deaths of 80 Americans as a result of the strike. Nevertheless, contrary to how it will be painted in Iran, the Iranian missile strike against America will be seen elsewhere as a fundamentally weak response to the death of its arch-terrorist general. The fact that Iran could strike these US bases with so many missiles and yet without the death of any US servicemen is not an accident. Prominent Iraqi analyst Michael Pridgent told BBC this morning that Iran used its precision-guided missiles in the attack to purposely miss the American side of these Iraqi bases. Take a listen.
They had to have the launch come from Iran to symbolize that it's a response to Qasem Soleimani's death. But they used precision-guided ballistic missiles in order to miss the American side of these Iraqi bases. The bad part of it is they actually injured Iraqis. But these 15 ballistic missiles that were launched without killing or injuring an American, and also the language sent to the United States that this is our proportionate attack. If you respond, we'll hit your allies in the region, and we may conduct attacks inside the United States. This is the de-escalation.
All told, the nature of this Iranian strike is an acknowledgement that President Trump's killing of Qasem Soleimani and his clear red line on American casualties have temporarily restored United States deterrence against Iranian attacks. Since coming into office, President Trump and his administration have forthrightly acknowledged Iran as the foremost sponsor of terrorism in the world and the dangerous belligerent in the Middle East. Contrary to past United States administrations, Trump has not allowed the Iranian regime to hide behind its proxy organizations. Instead, the president has consistently blamed Iran for the actions of its proxy network, whether Hezbollah, the Houthis, Hamas, or Shiite militias in Iraq. And when one of those proxies killed a U.S. citizen in Iraq on December 27th and orchestrated a march on the U.S. embassy a week later, President Trump exacted revenge not on those proxies, but on Iran. This crucial change in the United States' perception of Iran and how it acts against it was acknowledged in Lee Smith's piece at Tablet Magazine on Tuesday night. Smith wrote this: "In making Iran accountable, Trump has knocked down Iran to its natural size and likely made Americans safer from Iranian aggression than they have been at any point in the past 40 years, during which Iranian proxies have repeatedly killed large numbers of Americans. Killing Soleimani is a much more important operation than those targeting Islamic State leader al-Baghdadi and even bin Laden, since it will likely shape the future actions of a state, not the leadership rotation of terror groups." Smith continues, "Iranian-backed terror isn't a stubborn, unchanging fact of the international landscape, except to the degree that we made it so. The policy of appeasement that began in 1979 with the embassy takeover culminated in the 2015 Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, when the Obama administration flooded Soleimani's war chest with hundreds of billions of dollars and legitimized Iran's right to a large-scale nuclear weapons program. In line with the decades-long U.S. policy of augmenting the Iranian threat in order to avoid taking action against it, Obama said the only alternative to giving Iran the bomb was war. Donald Trump was vilified when he exited the Iran deal in May, but in the eyes of the foreign policy establishment, he committed an even graver sin by exposing the 40-year-old lie that U.S. policymakers right and left had cultivated to rationalize their collective unwillingness to protect Americans from Iranian terror." End quote. In acknowledging that Iran is the head of the terrorist snake and holding Iran responsible for the acts of its proxies, President Trump has been able to restore deterrence against future attacks. However, that deterrence does not announce the end of the Iranian regime or the beginning of the end even. In fact, there are some worrying signs that after this face-saving Iranian reprisal, President Trump could make a decision that actually empowers the Iranian regime even more. In the hours following the strike, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei gave a thunderous speech broadcast throughout Iran, stating that the people of Iran slapped America in the face with the missile strike. The crowd followed with the usual "death to America" and "death to Israel" chants. Even Khamenei acknowledged that he was not satisfied with just the limited strike. He also called for the ousting of U.S. forces from the Middle East. He said, quote, "This kind of attack is not enough. The U.S. must be uprooted from the region because they brought destruction to this region," Khamenei stated. The Ayatollah's link of the soft missile attack from Iran to the removal of the United States forces from the region is interesting, considering a letter that made it to press on Monday. This letter was from the United States Army to Iraqi Military Joint Operations Command, announcing that the United States was willing to move its forces out of Iraq. The letter was sent to Iraqi Prime Minister Adel Abdul Mahdi, who said he received a copy of the letter in both English and Arabic. Abdul Mahdi said that he had asked for clarifications of the letter because there seemed to be differences in the Arabic and English versions. While the United States came out and claimed the letter was a draft and not the real thing, the fact that the draft existed shows that the United States is considering removing its forces from Iraq. Furthermore, many of President Trump's most vocal supporters believe that right now, following the attack on Qasem Soleimani, would be the best time to extricate U.S. forces from Iraq. Lee Smith, author of The Plot Against the President, wrote the following for the New York Post this morning. The targeted killing of Iranian Quds Force commander Qasem Soleimani last week broke an old taboo. Finally, a U.S. president held Iran responsible for the proxies it uses to kill Americans. It was a strategic victory for President Trump and an opportunity to roll it into a political masterstroke as well, the immediate and complete withdrawal of U.S. troops from Iraq. End quote. In this piece, Smith lays out the case that despite the fact that America has spent billions of U.S. dollars and thousands of American lives, Tehran has more influence with Baghdad than Washington does. Smith continued this way. Those who advocate staying in Iraq are arguing largely from an admirable but impractical principle that the U.S. must not cut and run. From that perspective, surrendering Iraq would give Soleimani one final victory from beyond the grave. In reality, Smith writes, a U.S. withdrawal is more likely to cause problems for Tehran. The departure of the U.S. forces would restore the regional dynamics to the natural state in which Iran is a Persian Shiite power surrounded by a sea of Sunni Arabs more keen for revenge than ever after the depredations suffered over the last two decades in Iraq as well as in Syria. Now, while Smith is correct on his point that Tehran's influence in Iraq is greater than the United States, his following point, that the Sunni Arabs would be able to counter Iran's position when America withdraws from Iraq, is far from assured. One could argue, as President Trump may, that it's not the United States' problem whether or not the Sunni Arabs can stand up to Iran. Indeed, President Trump may follow Smith's advice and use Soleimani's death to let, quote, us get out of the Iraqi quagmire on a high note. However, it's hard to not view surrendering Iraq as the final victories to Soleimani from beyond the grave, especially in light of what Bible prophecy says about Iraq and Iran. President Trump may have restored deterrence against Iran by killing General Qasem Soleimani. However, the fact that the United States is considering leaving Iraq at this very moment shows that Iran's power in the region will not diminish in the long run.
Thank you very much for that, Brent. This is probably the best example we've seen of just how closely the interests of the American press align with those of Iran and America's enemies. You know, you get the feeling like they would be happy if these Iranian strikes actually did kill 80 Americans and that the worst possible outcome would be all this dying down and Iran retreating from this war footing.
Yeah, I think what's really interesting about this is it shows just how much Iran believed that Trump had a red line, you kill American servicemen, and he is going to respond. So much so that, as we brought out in that report, they deliberately targeted these missiles in areas where U.S. casualties would not take place because they feared a reprisal attack. And there was no hot war. It looks like there is de-escalation. Iran doesn't want to go ahead and strike U.S. forces. We'll see. One of its rogue proxies might come out of the woodwork and you know, claim some retribution for Qasem Soleimani's death. But it's not coming from the Iranian regime.
So once again, it appears another sign of just how effective American power is when it's actually used.
Right.
Right. I mean, that's what Lee Smith brings out in his piece is for 40 years, we have kind of pandered to Iran and this idea of plausible deniability that if they use a proxy, well, maybe it wasn't ordered by the Iranian regime, whether it's, you know, attacking the U.S. embassy back in Iran or whether it's talking about the Beirut bombing or all the other terrorist attacks in the Middle East and elsewhere. There's been no retribution on the Iranian state itself or Iranian military officials. Trump said, I acknowledge you as the head of the snake. You're causing all this, and so I'm going to attack you with this one strike against Soleimani. And Iran fully believes that President Trump would have responded against the regime had they taken out American servicemen in the attack overnight.
Right. Yeah, I'm just reminded back in when was it in 2003 maybe when the United States was ramping up all of its activity in the Middle East. It went into Iraq, and you had this, what we learned in retrospect was that Iran actually backed away from its nuclear activities during that time, that they do respond to aggression, that they're not just kind of, they don't have a death wish, they're not willing to launch a war that they're not actually able to do something about. They like to operate in the shadows, and as soon as the president calls them out on this, then they retreat.
Yeah, in many parts of the world, the law of the jungle still exists. And it's when you're perceived as weak, others will walk all over you. When you're strong, then, you know, even the other strongest would back down. You bring up 2003, yeah, Iran slowed down its nuclear program. Qasem Soleimani actually approached the American generals at the time, just after Saddam Hussein was ousted, and asking whether they wanted to work together. And the U.S. actually backed away and said, no, we don't want to work with you. And then 2 years later is when Soleimani started up his attacks against U.S. servicemen when he saw that the United States lacked a bit of will to follow through. And so initially back then, even Soleimani was pretty sheepish in the face of American power.
What's so interesting is, despite that being a very obvious takeaway here, that if America does exercise its power and it does actually show that it has the will to do something like this, it seems like the big takeaway, and you talked about this in your report, conservatives like Lee Smith and Victor Davis Hanson, they're basically saying this gives America a perfect way to get out of Iraq. We can leave on a high note with Soleimani's death. And just judging by that document that you mentioned showing that America wants out as well, it seems like this is what's on President Trump's mind as well.
Yeah, certainly. I think a couple of these men, like you mentioned, Lee Smith, Victor Davis Hanson, people we've been watching for a number of times, people we quote often because of a lot of their conservative views and their understanding of history, are both encouraging the president to get out of Iraq right now. And it makes sense that he would have that they would have President Trump's ear in some ways. And we know that this is something that the U.S. is considering with this draft letter that went out that the United States tried to play down, that basically said that was a letter to the Iraqis saying, we're going to acknowledge your vote in the parliament and that you want us out. We're going to acknowledge the will of the prime minister, and we're going to slowly withdraw and move our troops elsewhere. And the U.S. said, oh, it was a draft. We were just circulating to see what some people thought. Well, it got all the way to Baghdad. It got all the way to the prime minister. The prime minister of Iraq has a signed copy of this letter. He had two copies, one in Arabic, one in English, and there was slight discrepancy. So he asked for a clarification from the U.S. It looks like this got a whole lot further than the U.S. would like to admit at this stage. However, going forward, I think this is something that Mr. Trump would have to look at really realistically. He doesn't want to be in the Middle East. He's got a lot of people that he trusts commentating or talking to him saying that this is the time to get out. You've just had a good victory. It's not going to end well for us inside Iraq right now because of Iran's huge power inside that nation. I think it's time for us to leave and bring our boys home. And that wouldn't be surprising. I would say over the next couple of days or even a few weeks, we see the United States take moves towards that.
Well, that's definitely what Bible prophecy suggests is going to happen. It could happen quite soon. We will definitely keep our eyes on it. We've been talking with trumpet writer Brent Noctegal about these retaliatory strikes by Iran against the United States. He wrote an article last night. It's up now at watchjerusalem.co.il. The title, Iran's Face-Saving Missile Strike Against U.S. Bases. Go check that out. And I'd also highly recommend you listen to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show from this morning. Stephen Flory did an excellent job of exposing the hypocrisy in the American press coverage of what's happening here. Nice work today, Brent. Thanks so much for your time.
No problem.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
Qasem Soleimani has been killed, and his bloody rampage is now forever gone.
Iranian General Qasem Soleimani was one of the most dangerous killers in the world. He's been undermining American efforts in the Middle East, even actively leading the fight against American forces for at least 15 years. If President Barack Obama had removed this man, the press surely would have universally praised the wisdom of his decision, even more than they did when he authorized the killing of Osama bin Laden. But because it was President Donald Trump who ordered the strike that killed Soleimani, the press has decided not to applaud the decision, but to label it ill-conceived and reckless, and simultaneously to lionize this Iranian general.
He was a war hero, the commander of Iran's feared Quds force.
Qasem Soleimani was no ordinary general. The U.S. officially classified him as a terrorist, but in Iran, he was a national hero.
He's regarded as personally incredibly brave. The troops love him.
I was trying to think of somebody, and I was thinking of De Gaulle.
A revered figure in Iran and some other places in the Middle East.
Smart, charismatic, ruthless, strategic, and bold. His power made Iranians proud.
But even many of Soleimani's enemies admitted he was a military genius.
Qasem Soleimani was an evil genius.
Soleimani was in charge of spreading Iranian influence around the world, and he was extremely good at it.
He is the, think of the French Foreign Legion, you know, if you will.
By killing Qasem Soleimani, the U.S. has stripped Iran of an inspirational military leader.
The crowds are massive and emotional. There are many tears here.
Thousands of mourners on the streets in Iran. Symbolic caskets aloft, weeping and chanting, "I am Soleimani."
The supreme leader of Iran weeping and praying over a coffin draped in the Iraqi flag.
It's difficult to convey how revered he is.
There was talk in Iran Soleimani might be a future president, or perhaps even a supreme leader.
Most of the media and leftist political class said that removing this terrorist kingpin was a mistake. But one of the commentators on MSNBC put a very interesting twist on that view, and not necessarily that the act was a mistake, but just who carried it out. This is what he said, MSNBC.
Right. I think that's what's maybe most frightening about it. Let's assume for a minute that he was at the Baghdad airport and deserved this. Okay. Let's just stipulate that. And let's just say maybe it was the right decision to take him out. But you have, in that case, right decision, wrong commander in chief. So you need somebody at the helm who can navigate skillfully an extraordinarily complex set of events that he has now set in motion.
So maybe it was the right decision, but it should have been someone else carrying it out. That is the way virtually everyone in the press, the entire Democrat Party, and so many Americans think about this president. Most of the time, he's doing the wrong thing. Most of the time, he's destroying society. He's unraveling the international order. He's reckless. He's racist. He's idiotic and stupid. But in the odd case where maybe he makes a right decision, well, he's just not the right man to be doing that. In their eyes, he's wrong even when he's right. This illustrates a remarkable aspect of human nature that we see on full display in America today, in a way that's dividing us, that's hurting us, that's hastening our nation's downfall. Shakespeare's play Othello tells the story of an impressive military general, Othello, who's just gotten married, and his traitorous standard bearer, Iago, who is determined to destroy his life. Iago is ambitious, and he's jealous of Cassio, whom Othello has just raised in rank to his second in command. So Iago hatches a plot to sabotage Cassio's reputation and ruin Othello's marriage, all in one swoop. He begins to insinuate that Othello's wife, Desdemona, is in love with Cassio. Now, this is total deceit. There's no truth in it. There's no truth to it. Desdemona is completely faithful to Othello. The way that she's portrayed is she's totally without sin or fault. Now, at first, Othello dismisses the accusation as nonsense. But then it begins turning over in his mind. He lashes out in anger against Iago. He demands that Iago prove his wife's crime. "Give me the ocular proof," he says. But Iago is very canny. First, he presents himself as being absolutely loyal to Othello, completely trustworthy, completely devoted and loving. He lies through his teeth about his intentions. He feigns devotion. He feigns humility. He acts like, well, he's doubting his own perceptions. He's loath to reveal his suspicions. He convinces Othello to drag out of him what he has on his mind. And then he lays out his case, piece by piece. This little bit of insinuation, this wisp of suggestion. He makes a grand case of this special handkerchief that Othello had given Desdemona. He manages to take it and place it in Cassio's bedroom, leading Othello to draw his own conclusions. And once these ideas begin finding lodgment in Othello's mind, they start poisoning his thinking. Soon, everything Othello sees confirms this completely false idea that his wife is unfaithful. Iago had set Cassio up and framed him for some indiscretion when he's supposed to be on the watch, and then he convinced Othello to remove Cassio from his office. Then Iago convinces Cassio to ask Desdemona to make the case to Othello for reinstating him. And she's happy to do that. She's completely unaware that her husband already suspects her of being in love with Cassio. So you have these heartbreaking scenes of an innocent Desdemona petitioning her husband on Cassio's behalf, which only confirms in Othello's mind this lie that Cassio is her true love. So the story leads step by painful step to the tragic conclusion. Othello is so convinced of his wife's treachery that he kills her. Now, I take two main lessons from this play that are very relevant to what's happening in American politics today, and not just in the aftermath of the Soleimani killing, but more broadly. First is the appalling damage that can be done by a lying, two-faced, unscrupulous villain. The Iago character is essentially the devil. Jesus Christ said he is a liar and the father of it. He has no restraints. He's willing to do anything to accomplish his evil purposes. He'll lie, he'll cheat, he'll steal, he'll destroy others' reputations, he'll murder, and he'll come as an angel of light. He'll present himself as harmless, impartial, kind, devoted to justice and peace, but he's only motivated by self-interest, and he'll destroy anyone who gets in his way. Any action is justified to fulfill his ambitions. When you have somebody operating in that way, without restraint, without scruples, without morals, he can be terribly destructive. This last weekend, our editor-in-chief, Gerald Flurry, aired a Key of David program about the hidden Antiochus. And it's a very deep program. It's really worth studying into. he talks about this very satanic individual, Antiochus Epiphanes. This is one of the worst villains in Jewish history. He was the leader of the Seleucid kingdom. He wanted to stamp out the Jewish religion, and he did so through deceit and then through coercion and violence. And Mr. Fleury went through a prophecy in Daniel 8 about how that history points to the end time, to events in our day. And he shows how there's an Antiochus type within God's own church and also an end time Antiochus who leads Europe. But then he showed how there's also an Antiochus within America, that the devil uses an individual to bring the nation down from within. This man uses deceit. He pretends to be something that he isn't. He's a smooth and attractive and flattering man. He comes as an angel of light, but he destroys the nation in many ways. And that has happened in America. There has been an individual fulfilling that role. But he's also led a movement operating in the spirit of Antiochus that is doing a horrifying amount of damage. Even still, it's still going on. And you have to understand the devil to really understand the scale of what is happening. The Apostle Paul said in 2 Corinthians 2 and verse 11, lest Satan should get an advantage of us, for we are not ignorant of his devices. He's basically saying you can't afford to be ignorant of the way that Satan operates, or else you're going to be his victim. And Satan has a lot of devices. But the character of Iago in this play perfectly depicts this spirit at work in American politics today. There are people with an ambition to destroy lives and to undermine the state. They're willing to do anything to accomplish their goals, lying, cheating, deceit, duplicity, even violence. Virtually nothing is off the table. And this is being exposed more and more. If you're paying attention, you see the kinds of acts that they are willing to take in order to accomplish their ambitions. If you're ignorant of the workings of an Iago or an Antiochus, if you're ignorant of Satan's devices, then you'll be deceived. You'll become his victim. That's why we talk about this so much at The Trumpet. You hear about this a lot on The Trumpet Daily Radio Show with Stephen Fleury, and booklets that we have like America Under Attack and articles that we have in the print edition of The Trumpet. We're trying to help you see the real danger, the real nature of the enemy, the spiritual dimension to the attacks on this country that are taking place before our eyes. The second lesson that I take from Shakespeare's play Othello is the danger in faulty preconceptions. Othello is unwise to Iago's deceit, and he's susceptible to insinuation and suggestion. So once he becomes convinced of his innocent wife's betrayal, then everything he sees serves to confirm that preconception. He begins to manufacture evidence in his own mind that prove his suspicions. The most innocuous words and acts become unerring validation of her supposed villainy. There's one point where Iago says, "Trifles light as air are to the jealous, confirmation strong as proofs of holy writ." It's a tragic illustration of the danger in confirmation bias. One definition is confirmation bias is the tendency to search for, interpret, favor, and recall information in a way that affirms one's prior beliefs. In other words, preconception deeply influences perception. And this enables people to see crimes that aren't there. It causes people to work themselves into a frenzy over imaginary sins. And this is exactly what we're seeing play out in grand fashion in American politics today. There are definitely, unquestionably, some Iagos at work. People who are deliberately putting forth lies. They're trying to poison the air with false stories aimed at bringing their enemies down and accomplishing their own evil political ends at whatever cost. But there are also a lot of Othellos, people who are buying into these lies, and they're allowing themselves to be influenced and swayed by this disinformation. And now their own imaginations are creating evidence of criminality where there is none. Everything they see confirms the fictional treachery of which they've convinced themselves. Viewed through this distorting lens, then the killing of the world's most dangerous terrorist mastermind becomes a reckless mistake, the unjust murder of a beloved military hero. Or at best, well, it's the right decision, but it was just made by the wrong commander-in-chief. Viewed through this distorting lens, no amount of exculpatory evidence can convince them that the president isn't guilty of any number of crimes. Collusion with the Russians, or being a Russian stooge, colluding with the Ukrainians, blowing a dog whistle to rally white supremacists across America to undertake the genocide of black people. Any number of crimes and sins that are actually contrivances of the imagination. It seems that once someone has gone down that path far enough, it can be nearly impossible to open their eyes to the truth. As Shakespeare wrote it, it led to the most perverse and grievous outcome. That's what makes Othello such a tragic play. How will America's story end? The spirit of Iago is strong. The spirit of Antiochus, the spirit of the devil, and more people are being influenced to a dangerous degree by that spirit. I saw a video the other day of a conservative student at a college campus with a table and a sign in a public square advertising his views. And another student came by and told him, take that sign down, get out, you're inciting violence. Well, the student said he wasn't inciting violence. He was just stating his political views. He had the freedom of speech to do that. The second student punched him in the face, totally cold-cocked him. It was as blatant an example of hypocrisy as you could witness. He accuses another student of inciting violence and then deals with it by absolutely drilling him in the face. And I'm sure in his mind he felt perfectly justified that he was there to try to preserve peace. We all need to open our eyes to recognize the devil's influence in our world. Don't be ignorant of his devices. Don't let him get advantage over you. Recognize how he's playing human nature to sow division and hatred within America. Prophecy says it's going to get far worse. And it's a big reason why the story we are writing as a nation will end up being such a tragedy. To learn more about the devil's influence on America today, go to thetrumpet.com, go to the literature tab, and read Gerald Fleury's booklet, America Under Attack.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
The Bible prophesies that the Roman Catholic Church will play a significant role in European politics in the time ahead, and also that it will reconcile with and reabsorb churches that have broken away from it through the centuries, including the Eastern Orthodox Church. A development in that church could hasten the fulfillment of that prophecy, as we will now hear in this report from Andrew Miller.
The Eastern Orthodox Church is breaking apart. The Russian Orthodox Church cut ties with the Patriarch of Alexandria on December 26, following his decision to recognize an independent Ukrainian Orthodox Church. This schism follows the Russian Orthodox Church decision to cut ties with the Archbishop of Athens and the Ecumenical Patriarch of Constantinople. Both leaders also recognize the new Ukrainian Orthodox Church. There are 14 universally recognized Orthodox churches. plus the Orthodox Church of America and the Orthodox Church of Ukraine, which are not universally recognized. Until recently, the Russian Orthodox Church held jurisdiction in Russia, Ukraine, and other former Soviet nations. Therefore, Patriarch Kirill of Moscow opposes all attempts to recognize an independent Ukrainian Orthodox Church. Yet Orthodox churches in Egypt, Greece, and Turkey have done so anyway. This development is splitting the Orthodox churches into pro-Ukrainian and pro-Russian factions. If the Eastern Orthodox Church breaks up over Ukraine, the pro-Russian faction will likely draw even closer to Moscow, while the pro-Ukrainian faction will draw closer to the Roman Catholic Church. The Eastern Orthodox Church split from the Catholic Church in the 11th century. The Roman Catholic Church has been trying to bring the Eastern Orthodox Church back under its dominion since the 1970s, but negotiations have stalled over the Eastern Orthodox Church's refusal to accept the authority of the Pope. Yet, according to a report by the Union of Orthodox Journalists, Ecumenical Patriarch Bartholomew of Constantinople told several abbots and monks last November that there were no dogmatic differences in doctrine between Orthodoxy and Catholicism, and that eventual reunion with Rome is inevitable. The news site Angelus published an editorial titled, "Could the Reunion Between Catholic and Orthodox Be Closer Than We Thought?" It highlights that the biggest obstacle to Catholic-Orthodox unity is tensions between Rome and Moscow. Yet if the Orthodox Church splits into pro-Ukrainian and pro-Russian factions, the pro-Ukrainian faction may move towards reunification with the Catholic Church, unencumbered by Moscow's politics. For over 40 years until his death in 1986, Plain Truth Editor-in-Chief Herbert W. Armstrong forecast that the Roman Catholic Church would pull its Protestant and Eastern Orthodox daughters back under its dominion as it rose up to rule over a united Europe. The November 1963 issue of The Plain Truth stated, "The mighty problem of achieving unity is twofold. First, it involves reconciliation of the Orthodox schism that officially commenced in 1054 and divided the churches in the East, Greece, Russia, the Balkans, and the Near East, from Rome. Second, it involves the restoration to the Roman Communion all Protestantism, which developed from 1517 onward." This prediction was based on a prophecy in Isaiah 47, which describes a church called the Lady of Kingdoms that has power over many nations. Yet this church has protesting daughter churches that have split away. The prophet Isaiah states that these protesting daughters will be brought back under their mother's control. This mother will rise to prominence in the end time, exerting great influence over a European superstate. The Roman Catholic Church has signed agreements with Orthodox, Lutheran, Methodist, Anglican, and other religious groups in its push to unify the world, and especially Europe, under its control. Political tensions with Ukraine may present a stumbling block to the Vatican's efforts to reabsorb the Russian Orthodox Church, but it will not stop Rome from reabsorbing other Eastern Orthodox patriarchates. Just as Eastern Europe is being divided between a German-led European Union and a Russian-led Eurasian Union, it is also being divided between the Roman Catholic Church, led by Rome, and the Orthodox Church, increasingly led by Moscow.
Thank you for that, Andrew. Definitely a subject that isn't getting a lot of front page headlines in a lot of papers outside of those that are immediately concerned with what's going on here, but real prophetically significant ramifications to what you're talking about here. I'd like to go back to that quote that you gave from Herbert Armstrong, and you said 1963, he's talking about this, the fact that the Roman Catholic Church has two main goals. One of them is to reconcile with the Protestants and bring the Protestants back into its fold, but also the reconciliation of this Orthodox schism. At the time that he gave that prophecy, based on what the Bible says, Russia wasn't really in the picture in terms of the Russian Orthodox Church, the way that it has developed to the point we see it today, is quite a bit different from that time. Maybe you could just help us to understand, say, the origins of that schism and what it looked like, say, at the time that Herbert Armstrong said that versus what we see today.
Right, yeah, because it has changed quite a bit. Because, like, at the time Mr. Armstrong writing this in the 1960s, there were still the same universally recognized 14 different Eastern Orthodox churches on the world scene, but the Russian Orthodox Church was behind the Iron Curtain. It was in the atheist Soviet Union. It was very repressed. The Soviets was officially atheist state, so they didn't have much political power in the world. And so as the Catholic Church is looking at bringing healing this Orthodox schism, they're reaching out to some of these oppressed churches behind the Iron Curtain, and there was definitely this era of, like, warm feelings between the Roman Catholic Church and the Orthodox Church. And Mr. Armstrong was basing this prophecy in Isaiah 47 about the daughter churches coming back to the mother church, and putting it in context of bringing back the Orthodox churches on the one hand and the Protestant churches on the other. Now, since that time when the Soviet Union fell, the Russian Orthodox Church stopped being oppressed by the state. And then after Vladimir Putin rose to power in Russia, he even developed close political ties with the Russian Orthodox Church. Patriarch Kirill of Moscow is widely rumored to have been a KGB agent himself, same as Vladimir Putin. So you've got, like, this church-state union in Russia with Kirill and Putin working together. And in some ways, I've even seen analysts saying that Putin's kind of using the Russian Orthodox Church like the Soviets use the Communist Party, as kind of like the ideological glue putting his empire together, because he's looking at talking about, like, reunion with Belarus and reunion with Ukraine and reunion with these Baltic states that are all Orthodox states. And so Orthodoxy is kind of the common ideology here. And so now that the Russian Orthodox Church has their own strong man there who supports them, they're much less keen to make any compromises with the Vatican.
So the Bible prophesies that the Roman Catholic Church will be the ideological glue binding a European Union together. And to see this division taking place between Russian Orthodox and the Ukrainian Orthodox, and these other Eastern Orthodox churches siding with the Ukrainian position, which is more of a pro-Rome position, a pro-Western, a pro-European position, it really does have some political ramifications in terms of this division between a European empire and an Asian conglomerate. At least it seems that that could play a role in which direction some of these countries take in that division.
Right, because if you're looking at church-state unity, obviously the Roman Catholic Church is trying to influence the politics of the European Union, same as the Russian Orthodox Church is trying to influence the politics of Vladimir Putin's Russia. And so, and seeing as that Russia and the European Union are geopolitical rivals in many ways, it makes it very hard for a church to be both both pro-Europe and pro-Russia. You almost kind of have to pick a horse in this race. But because, as we mentioned earlier, that the Russian Orthodox Church, you just hear that phrase, and especially a lot of Westerners, they almost, because their doctrines are so similar, they think of the Catholic Church in their mind. But it is really 14 different churches. There is no Patriarch Bartholomew of Constantinople is supposed to have primacy of honor amongst the Orthodox patriarchs, but a primacy of honor doesn't equal primacy of power. They give it's an honorary position, but the heads of these 14 churches kind of do their own thing in terms of politic wise. So it's like I said, just because Patriarch Kirill of Moscow has decided to throw his lot in with Vladimir Putin doesn't mean these other 13 churches have to. And that's really what this story is about, is that Patriarch Kirill has decided that the Ukrainians don't have a right to become another separate Orthodox church. But Patriarch Bartholomew of Constantinople decided they do. And so now you're having to see amongst these different churches, whose side do you take? Apparently Greece and Africa, Athens and Alexandria, have decided to back Patriarch Bartholomew and says that Ukraine has a right to become the 15th or 16th Orthodox church, depending if you count the Orthodox Church of America.
So it will be interesting to see whether this split that has taken place here does actually orient these other Eastern Orthodox churches more to accepting the primacy of Rome and seeing exactly the kind of healing of that schism that Herbert W. Armstrong prophesied. It certainly seems like a strong step in that direction. We've been talking with trumpet writer Andrew Miller about the state of the schism that has taken place between the Orthodox Church of Russia and that of other Eastern Orthodox churches. He's written an article that's up on thetrumpet.com. Is reunification of Catholic and Orthodox churches imminent? Check it out at the website. And thanks very much for your time, Andrew.
Thanks for having me.
It's time for today's last word.
A happy marriage is one of the greatest joys life has to offer. In this world, however, there's a great deal of failure surrounding marriage, but there need not be if only people would heed the author of marriage. God ordained marriage to the first man and woman he commanded, therefore shall a man leave his father and his mother and shall cleave unto his wife, and they shall be one flesh. You can read that in Genesis 2 and verse 24. So entering and fashioning a godly marriage begins with this understanding. God's earliest definition of marriage is leaving, cleaving, and becoming one. Marriage is the point where a man and wife leave the authority of their parents and form a new structure. Marriage establishes a new family, a new life with new responsibilities and new roles. Why did God create marriage? The answer is incredibly inspiring. When God gave Adam a helper in Genesis 2, that symbolized the church being wed to Jesus Christ at his second coming. God gave these two the ability to reproduce, which pictured the future expansion of the God family. And he made marriage permanent, which illustrates that the church's marriage to the Son of God will never end. God gives quite a lot of instruction in the Bible about how to make our marriages successful, particularly the individual roles and responsibilities of husband and wife. The most important chapter in the Bible explaining marriage is Ephesians 5, and it is a gold mine of marriage instruction. Even though this passage addresses the roles of husbands and wives, it actually primarily is talking about the marriage between Christ and the church. But the reason why the laws in that chapter apply to husband and wife is because physical marriage is a type of Christ's marriage. So both are governed by the same laws. It starts with verse 21, Ephesians 5, submitting yourselves one to another in the fear of God. Godly family life is a way of mutual submission in the fear of God. Now, in this passage, the Apostle Paul gets more specific about what submission looks like within each role, and he spells out the responsibilities of men and women in a way that reveals a lot about God's thinking and God's love and his government and his purpose for marriage. The two roles within a marriage interlock in an extraordinary way. Each of them is about service. Each demands 100% commitment to the way of give, the way of love. And it takes real faith for each spouse to go all the way. It takes faith in God and His law and His government to sacrifice your own notions, your own concepts. The vast majority of people are too selfish to do it. We walk by sight. We want to hold on to our own ideas of the way a relationship should function. But if we're willing to simply obey, to walk by faith and do as God commands, wonders and miracles result. When a husband and wife each devote themselves to following this formula, they set a God-level dynamic in motion. It creates a profound level of trust and intimacy and interdependence. God designed these roles and responsibilities to draw us into the world of the God family. They teach us exquisite God-level governance and love. None of us is perfect, but God requires that we strive to become perfect. No marriage is perfect either, but both husband and wife must work toward God's perfect standard. Wedding ceremonies generally end with the husband and the wife making their marriage vows. And the vows that we use in weddings in the Philadelphia Church of God come straight from the instruction in the Bible, a great deal of it from Ephesians 5. The man vows to cleave to his wife to death, to love her, cherish her, honor her, and provide for her. So there are five specific promises there: cleave, love, cherish, honor, and provide. They come straight from the Bible. When husbands understand and keep those vows, their marriages take on an awesome spiritual dimension, and they flow more and more with God's love and His Spirit and His blessings. The bride vows to take her husband for the remainder of her natural life, to submit herself to him as unto the eternal, to be subject to him in everything, and to deeply respect him. So these are completely different promises, but they are also based completely on the divinely inspired scriptures detailing a wife's obligations to her husband. Most of that can be found right there in Ephesians 5. These beautiful wedding vows, if they are kept, lead to marital harmony, happiness, stability, longevity. If you remember them and you keep them, you're going to enjoy rich rewards of a marriage governed and blessed by the Almighty Creator of marriage. He wants your marriage to be great. He created this magnificent God-plane relationship, and He wants it to be a rich, joy-filled, deeply satisfying, intimate, and altogether loving experience for everyone who enters into it. If you want to learn more about God's purpose for marriage, then read Herbert W. Armstrong's booklet, Why Marriage Soon Obsolete. You can find it at thetrumpet.com under the literature tab. I'm Joel Hilliker, and that is it for today's Trumpet Hour. You can send me any thoughts you have on today's program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to my guests, Brent Noctegal and Andrew Miller. Thanks to Nick Irwin and Dwight Falk for engineering and production. I'll leave you with this thought from Johann Wolfgang von Goethe: every man hears only what he understands. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.